I like it.
Okay. Today is Friday, March 6, 2015. I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Open an informational meeting on serving Oregonians with disabilities. And I call on Lillian Kennedy, Director, Office of Developmental Disability Services at DHS, Mike McCormick, Director of Aging and People with Disabilities at DHS, and Eric Belt, Director of Statewide Veterans Services. Thank you for joining us. We've got Representative Joe Gallegos on the phone. Representative Kathleen Taylor is excused, and I think everyone else will be coming in.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, thank you for having us here. For the record, my name is Mike McCormick. I'm the director for the Aging and People with Disabilities Program within the Department of Human Services. And then to my left.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. My name is Lilia Tenenty. I'm the director for the Office of Developmental Disability Services in DHS.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here. Chair Kenny Geyer, my name is Eric Belt. I work for the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs. I'm the Statewide Veteran Services Division Director.
So, again, thank you for having us here. Today we're going to be providing really a 10,000-foot view of disabilities in Oregon and some of the services that we provide to Oregonians who have disabilities. It's going to be very high level. Of course, you know, at any time we're welcome to come back and present more detailed information on any topics of interest. So often when people think of disabilities, they think of the long-term care services that DHS provides to Oregonians. So in DHS, we have two very significant long-term care programs. I manage the one within Aging and People with Disabilities, and it serves seniors, people 65 or older, along with people who have a physical disability as determined by criteria set by the Social Security Administration. Now, just because you're one of those, you fall into one of those two groups, does not mean that you're eligible for long-term services and supports. We also have what we call a level of care criteria, meaning that someone can demonstrate that they have needs for these types of services. And when I talk about these services, I'm talking about services in a nursing facility, services in assisted living, direct care services in a person's own home, things that keep people independent, healthy, and safe, those types of services and supports.
And I am the director for the Office of Developmental Disabilities Services, and people served by the Office of Developmental Disabilities Services are children and adults that have been identified as having intellectual or developmental disabilities. And developmental disability can be described as someone having any one of the diagnoses that you see on the slide: Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, autism spectrum disorders, acquired brain injury. We also serve drug-affected children and individuals with intellectual disability. As with the program that Mike is speaking about with APD, in addition to having these particular diagnoses, they also have to meet our DD eligibility and level of care requirements in order to access our services. And the services that we provide are long-term care, long-term supports and services, assistance with activities of daily living, eating, dressing, bathing, the kinds of things that someone might need in order to live in their home, in their community. And then we also provide supports to people to go into the community. We also provide, because we serve a lot of young adults and adults, we are really focusing right now on employment supports as well, which we will talk about a little bit later.
Okay, so a lot of individuals believe that the disability determinations are done by the Social Security Administration somewhere in D.C., something like that. Well, that's not actually how it works. We have the Office of Disability Determination Services actually is within my program. They're contracted to provide disability determination services by the Social Security Administration. There's about 200 employees within this office, and I wanted to give you the criteria that they use in determining whether someone meets the federal definition of a disability, and that is listed here on this slide. Let me pause. Any questions before I move on? All right, so there are two types of disability determinations. SSI stands for Supplemental Security Income, and SSDI, Social Security Disability Insurance. And both types of those disabilities are done within our Disability Determination Services office. An interesting statistic is that one of four 20-year-olds will ultimately have a disability before reaching the age of 67. So this is really a big population. In 2014, we have 204,000 Oregonians receiving assistance with SSI or SSDI, and then on a per month basis, about $175 million in federal revenue is coming into Oregonians who have qualified with these disability determinations. So what does it look like? This is a 10-year chart, and it's not as dramatic as it might look, because this is, you know, around 57,000 people with disabilities are served in our local offices in July 2005, and in the most recent month, January 2015, we're at probably around 91,000. So it hasn't even doubled in a 10-year period. Granted, it is a sizable increase, but it's the kind of growth I think that you would expect, you know, to coincide with regular population growth.
Excuse me.
So,
can I have a question? Question?
Yes.
Population growth hasn't come close to that rate of growth in Oregon.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Bueller, you may be correct about that. I'm sorry. I didn't compare it to the population growth, so you may be correct.
Follow up?
Yes.
So why such a marked increase in the number of people with disability?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Bueller, during the economic downturn, there was a spike in individuals who were seeking disability determinations. Older Americans who, you know, they got laid off their work, could not find substantial employment after that, and may have sought a disability determination. There's also a correlation between the tremendous growth of the baby boomer population, and all of that growth is kind of hitting the disability determination system now. So someone who is 55 years old today, they are a baby boomer, and that's part of, you know, this big population growth.
And I'm assuming that, Eric, you will later talk about maybe Iraqi vets coming back into the, you know, whether that may have affected these numbers at all.
Chair Kenny Geyer, that is correct. I'll provide an overview and demographics of veterans.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Thank you, Chair. Would you clarify for me and help me to understand for seniors just with old age, okay, I mean, I personally right now have a friend in his late 90s, and so is there a point when we're talking about adult, you know, senior population and so forth, and the same population and disabilities, is there a point where some of the old age factor and the inability to get around your house suddenly turns, you know, shifts into a disability? Is that what happens there, or are those different categories?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark, those are different categories. So someone over, you know, 65 or older is not required to have a disability determination to qualify for our services. It's going to be a combination of income levels, the amount of resources, assets that they have, as well as meeting certain level of care requirements, meaning you have a demonstrated need for assistance.
Can I do a follow-up?
Yep.
On that, so on any of those demonstrated need for assistance, what is the turnaround time from when someone first tries to qualify for those or makes their first phone call to when they actually are evaluated to potentially would have services start? What's that process?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark, the expectation is that intakes happen very quickly, like within 14 days would be a good standard to do the intake to find out. And then from there, you would schedule an assessment with the individual, which would probably take, you know, a couple extra weeks. And then if the person is determined eligible, then the service planning process begins. And that could be, like, immediate if a person's already residing, say, in an assisted living facility. It could take more time if they were living in their own home and needed to find and recruit their own home care worker. So it varies, but I think a good rule of thumb is, you know, 1 to 2 months, that's going to be in place from when they enter the door.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So for those individuals that I was showing on that previous graph, these are the services that they're potentially eligible for. I don't want to suggest that all 91,000 are getting these services because they're absolutely not. But some of the programs in which they could be determined eligible, supplemental nutrition assistance programs, also known as food stamps, Oregon Health Plan, Medicare savings programs. So a lot of you know, Medicare is also open to people with disabilities, and there's premiums required in order to become, to access your Medicare benefit. And for some people that are really low income, they can't even afford the premiums. So it's in the state's best interest to pay the premium on behalf of that person so that Medicare becomes the first payer on all health care claims. And then the unpaid amount comes into Medicaid or the Oregon Health Plan to kind of settle the balance of it. So that's what the Medicare savings programs are. We talked about long-term services and supports. We also have staff that assist individuals with accessing disability benefits. Individuals, so think of an individual with, you know, severe and persistent mental illness who may not be following through on all of the requirements. The liaisons may help them complete all the required steps associated with that process. And of course, we also have like employment supports to help people with disabilities get back to work. And Lily will be talking about that in a little more detail later on. Yes, so that's a perfect segue, the emerging issues.
Oregon right now is engaged in a very significant effort called Employment First. About 40 states, in addition to Oregon, are also pursuing Employment First initiatives. And these initiatives really are driven to help people, especially with intellectual and developmental disabilities, access integrated competitive employment and jobs in their local communities. We've put a lot of effort into this in Oregon, and we've developed services that really are intended to help a person discover what it is they might want to do and what their interests are. We're coordinating with our Office of our Vocational Rehabilitation Services and our Department of Education for kids who are in teens transitioning into adulthood. And really the effort here is to really support in a way that encourages employment and really lets people know themselves, the students and their families know that integrated employment is possible for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And while they may know of and be aware of types of day programs and different things that occur in facility-based settings, we're really looking at how we can encourage and support and develop environments where we're helping people transition into competitively paid jobs in their local communities. And we've got a number of success stories around that, but this is something that we've been working on for some time and are continuing to work on. And so that's why, in terms of policy and emerging issues and things that we work on related to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, this is one of our primary goals right now. In addition, we've talked a lot in other hearings and other settings about Oregon's implementation of the Community First Choice option, or K plan option. And basically, this was as part of the last legislative session and approval of the 13-15 biennium budget, direction from the legislature to go to CMS and seek the approval for this Community First Choice plan. And what that did was it really it changed the way services, long-term supports and services are funded for Oregonians with disabilities. It added an enhanced 6% federal match. So now for services that are offered through the Community First Choice plan, the federal government contributes about 70 cents on every dollar that goes to these services. What it also did, and one of the things that policy issues that both APD and DD are working on, is that it opened the door to eligibility for services in a way that maybe, especially in the IDD system, hadn't occurred before. So children who meet our eligibility criteria now are able to access services. We have many children accessing services in in-home supports in their local communities. And adults, it changed the way we provide services for adults rather than really basing the supports on a functional needs assessment and assess level of need for the individual and then providing supports to match that assessment. As a result of this movement, the policy issues that we're looking at relate to how to make that sustainable. They also relate to our workforce issues. If you can imagine, we've got many more people who are able now to access funded services in long-term supports and in their communities, and so developing a workforce to come and provide those supports has been a critical part of these discussions.
And then the Aging and People with Disabilities Program is fully a partner in the Community First Choice option as well. So some of the discussions, you know, a lot of the states are having is how do we prepare our publicly funded long-term care systems for all of the baby boomers who are determined eligible, you know, who will ultimately be eligible for long-term care. I just saw, you know, a really disturbing statistic about the subpar savings rates of the baby boomer population, and so there's a lot of financial insecurity that's coming our way. So the Community First Choice option really positions Oregon well for the future and that anticipated growth, both for seniors and people with disabilities. It also includes some really great services that help people stay independent in their own homes, like at the Ways and Means hearing. I shared some great examples of work that our case managers were able to do to help Oregonians stay independent. Things like, you know, building a ramp so that they can get in and out of their home, a simple medication reminder for a person with mild dementia so that they remember to take their medications, those types of things. So I think while we are experiencing some growth out of the K plan, I really think it positions Oregon well for the future. The next thing that is being piloted this biennium as we speak is opening up Oregon Project Independence to people with disabilities. So this started in July, August of 2014. And so we're into this now. So Oregon Project Independence was established by the legislature in the early 80s as a program, you know, to provide a light touch to seniors to help them stay independent in their own homes. But it has never been opened up to people with disabilities. So it's being piloted as we speak, and there's a hope that that's being tested right now through this pilot about whether that light touch will help people with disabilities stay independent in their own homes and hopefully off of publicly funded assistance altogether. Because when you're in Medicaid, you're not eligible for Oregon Project Independence. So it's not just the long-term care cost that we're considering when we're piloting the Oregon Project Independence pilot. It's the total cost of public assistance that's being compared as part of this pilot. And that's what we had to discuss with you today. And we actually finished a little bit early if you have questions.
Nicely done.
Chair, I have a question.
I may be a little off track, but it concerns me, this one out of four 20-year-olds by 67. And I also realize funding things, but are we able to put together some sort of preventative plan so some of these sorts of things don't become disabilities, or how do we know that's going to happen?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Peluso, this statistic was actually published by the Social Security Administration. And if you're following some of the national news, there's a debate that's ongoing as we speak about the solvency of the Disability Trust Fund for Social Security. So these are the stats that are projected under today's program. And I know that, you know, Congress is setting up, you know, a debate on what the disability insurance program should look like in the future. But again, the criteria that they're using is going to be this right here. So if they're going to make changes to the definition of a disability, they're going to have to make changes in the criteria that's used to determine one's disability.
I guess I'm more concerned about, again, it just seems we work to correct things that perhaps could be prevented, and for one who's in complete denial that she's a baby boomer, it concerns me. So,
yes.
Thank you.
Understood.
Other questions? Okay. Karen.
Would you like to
thank
switch?
You.
But I'm hoping you can stay, though.
All right.
For questions at the end, or...
Oh, just
No. If there are other questions at the end.
Okay.
Again, for the record, good afternoon. My name is Eric Belt with the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs. As the statewide Veteran Services Director, it's my honor to represent Director Smith here today to provide you with an overview of ODVA and Oregon veterans, in particular the disabled veterans. So, for the first time in ODVA's 70-year history, our state is serving veterans spanning four generations and five wars. Unprecedented time of veterans that we're dealing with, from World War II to the present, returning veterans from Afghanistan and throughout the conflicts around the world. Approximately one out of 10 Oregonians is a veteran, and that adds up to a little over 320,000 veterans throughout the state. Not surprising, the majority of veterans live in the same place that the majority of Oregonians live, and that's through the I-5 corridor. If you look at the demographic breakdown of the wartime eras of veterans, you can see from World War II through Iraq and Afghanistan that Vietnam veterans make up the largest wartime percentage, a little over 37%. However, you hear most about Iraq-Afghan veterans, and that's 6.6%. We're rapidly losing our World War II veterans. If you'd looked at this statistic a year ago, it would have been double that, 6.5% of our population of veterans. And it includes veterans that have unique needs that that we strive to meet, whether it be aging veterans, disabled veterans, student veterans, women veterans, rural veterans, minority veterans, tribal veterans, or justice-involved veterans, and homeless. So these are all areas with Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark, do you have a question?
Sure. A quick question, if you don't mind, Vice Chair Peluso. When we're looking at veterans numbers and we're saying X number or X, you know, are veterans, I know there's different definitions for how long someone has served in order for them to receive different benefits and so forth. But what is, for these numbers, what is this, the definition of a veteran? Is it that they actually served beyond basic, you know, or if someone's discharged for medical reasons, does that count as a veteran for these numbers?
Vice Chair Representative Peluso and Representative Stark. Yes, for purposes of this population of veterans, we're looking at a total of the 322,000 are those who have served on active duty, or if they were a member of the Guard that they've been activated under presidential executive orders, for example, Title 10, to be deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, or perhaps they served 20 years, received their 20-year certificate in the Guard, and then they're also a veteran. So it may be medically discharged. They may have just served their obligation and been discharged, not been disabled. I'll give you the specific disability percentages in a few moments.
So if someone were, you know, a month into boot camp, if they were medically dismissed at that point, then for these, they would be included in these numbers?
That's correct.
Okay.
So since 9/11, nearly 31,000 Oregonians have deployed in recent conflicts, and almost 38% of those were, in fact, members of the Oregon National Guard and Reserve, so a significant percentage. The Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs is a small agency, and we rely greatly on our partnerships with the local other state agencies, as well as federal, as nonprofits, community-based, and faith-based organizations, in order to address the priorities of health, wellness, economic opportunity, education, employment, housing, compensation, and pension. Emergency services and transportation. And we have a very strong partnership with the county veteran service officers. There are 56 throughout the 34 counties that do provide veteran services, Marion and Polk being the two counties that ODVA provides direct services to those counties for veteran services. We also work, I'd like to highlight the work that we've done with, or are currently working with DHS for data sharing agreements, preparing to share data using the PARIS program, the Public Assistance Retrieval Information System, which is, if you flip on a filter, will filter out veterans who apply for services, for state services. And it serves a purpose to reduce duplication if they had signed up for services in, say, Arizona, moved to Oregon, and wanted to sign up here. It provides a targeting outreach tool to identify those veterans that might be most in need and might be able to maximize their veteran benefits if you use this tool as they apply for state benefits, and then minimize the need for some of those social services that the state has to pay for. Within ODVA, there are three core veteran programs: statewide Veteran Services Division, which I said I'm the director of that. I'll talk about that more in a minute. The Home Loan Program, Aging Veteran Services. The Home Loan Program is unique in that there are only four states within the country that actually provide, the State Department of Veteran Affairs provides that loan. This is separate and distinct from a federal VA home loan benefit that a veteran would have earned through their service. The Aging Veteran Services Program represents the two veteran homes, one of the Dalles, and then most recently, Lebanon came online. Each of those facilities can serve up to 150 residents, to include the veteran spouses. Statewide Veteran Services includes county veteran service offices, training and certification of those county veteran service officers, as well as state veteran service officers, VSOs. We provide a value-added benefit to the claims that are filed through the counties by providing a claims review and appeals work by ODVA. All the claims that are filed throughout the state in each county goes through my Portland office that's co-located with the federal VA's regional office. And so all those claims are reviewed for sufficiency before they're passed on. So we provide that aid and assistance to the veteran to obtain their benefits. We don't have a VSO does not have decision-making authority. We're working in partnerships with the county to develop high-quality claims that will benefit the veteran and be processed in a more timely, favorable manner if we do our work right. Also have conservatorship and educational aid and emergency assistance under the statewide veteran services. So just to recap, you see that the veterans' claims start through the county veteran service officers. If If they accept a power of attorney for them, that provides then that that veteran with legal representation of that VSO in order to through a power of attorney, and then based on that training and certification and claims review and appeal, pass those claims then up to the federal VA for the decision. And it takes, if all things go right, approximately 9 months for a decision to be made once it begin to be processed by the federal VA. So when you hear about the backlog within the VA, primarily that's referring to the backlog of claims for disability compensation through the VA's Veteran Benefits Administration. And here in Oregon, that's adjudicated through the Portland Regional Office of the VA.
Yeah. Question. Just a comment for three of us are on the Veterans Committee, so we hear this a lot. But just so for those of you who are not on the Veterans Committee, that number is really important because about the getting people through their claims process. Because the numbers that some of you may have read that say that it's a 39-month wait, those are real numbers. We are living those numbers at my house right now, so I can tell you they're the truth. We're at 36 months. And for our lowest income veterans who do not have otherwise access to health care, or if they need mental health services, you can't wait 36 months for the VA to move. And that's really sort of, as we look at, I know, you know, Rep. Evans has bills, I've had bills, continue to have bills that deal with having state funding to do gap health care for these folks. We'll eventually see those dollars back when they're connected to their VA benefits, but while, you know, you see 3 out of 10, so that means we're not serving 7 out of 10, 225,000 Oregonians who are somewhere either trying to connect to benefits or don't even know they have benefits. It's putting a huge burden on our social service system when we're running those people through DHS and OHA when they should be properly aligned with the Department of Veterans Affairs, and they are not. So I just really want to call your attention to that because it is costing our general fund money to not be spending a little bit of money to properly align people with their benefits, which then brings our federal dollar back. So those folks are typically the people who are in homeless crises, mental health crises. When we talk about how do we keep a suicide line on, it's that 7 out of 10 that we're trying to serve that are not connected, and it should be a priority for all of us. So, and I see Rep. Evans wants to chime in.
Chair and members of the committee, I want to support everything Parrish just said. The other piece, just for folks to think in dollars and cents terms, 5 years ago when we did the task force, the numbers were a little higher. We've lost some vets since then, but at that point it was 349,000. Now it's down to 322,000. Bottom line, two components, two factors are essential to understand the difference about veteran services versus many others, and even the way some veterans think about it. The first is VA is required by law to meet the needs of the veterans that are in the system. If you're not in the system, you don't exist. So when people talk about waits for hospitals, waits for CBOCs, waits for other things, part of the problem is many veterans don't think that they deserve any type of care, and maybe they don't have anything wrong with them, but when the VA looks to source for particular populations, they're looking at the 80 to 90,000 that are in the system versus the 322,000 that are in the system. So if you know a vet that hasn't gone through the process, grab them by the ear, take them in, get them in the system. Even if they get zero compensation rating, they're at least a bean that's counted toward the number of veterans so that the hospital services, transportation services, all those other things get better. In terms of dollars and cents, though, here's the deal. All of the stuff that has been done and the number of veterans that are in the system, I think, is somewhere between $1.2, $1.3 billion in revenues coming into the state. I think that's still pretty close.
Compensation and pension.
Right, compensation and pension. If you brought in the 225-plus thousand that are currently not in the system, and they're approximately at the same rates, some people 10%, some people 60%, whatever, you're talking about $4 billion that we are so stupid that we're leaving on the table. Okay. So let me say it again, $4 billion. So when Representative Parrish, myself, and others are trying to fight for dollars for outreach and expansion of services, it actually, on the conservative side, is a 1 to 5 $1 million spent and $5 million coming in direct payment compensation benefits. But if you actually look at all total factors in terms of business loans, home loans, all the economic activity, it's somewhere closer to $1 of state funds brings in $1,000 of federal funds. So it is the smartest investment we can make. And, oh, by the way, it happens to be the right thing to do. Thank you
very
much.
Well, and thank you for those comments. But and also, it's not just the revenue, but when you don't invest in that way, those problems accumulate and get worse and worse and more expensive to pay. Yes. It's a lot like the general assistance program that we had to postpone because we were going to hear it on Wednesday. But same kind of idea.
Chair, I have one more comment. Mm-hmm. So Washington State has been very successful using a system that reaches into their DHS and human service systems, healthcare systems, to go and find those veterans and mm-hmm. properly align them. Mm-hmm. They still provide, until I believe, as I understand, they still provide coverage and care and support services using state money until they are fully transitioned over to whatever mm-hmm. services they're eligible by the VA. In doing that and sort of helping people get through the get through that process, they have saved their state's general fund millions of dollars. Not like a few bucks. We're talking, you know, millions and millions and millions every year out of their general fund that they are then able to go use for other things mm-hmm. that, you know, we all care about, schools and roads and whatever else we want to spend those dollars on. So because we're not doing that, not only are, you know, you heard Paul say we're leaving, you know, billions of dollars on the table, we're also eating up millions of dollars out of our general fund unnecessarily by not making these investments. And, you know, I've been banging this drum since I've been here, Representative Matthews before us banging those drums. But this is a really, it's nice that you guys are here talking about this and we can actually have some folks who are not in our empty veterans committees hear this same thing. And as we go through the rest of this slide deck, hopefully it will sort of inspire the folks on this committee that, you know, asking for some funds and permanently locking them down is actually a net income benefit to the state of Oregon. Even if you don't want to help veterans, the reality is that the money that they have earned, we send Uncle Sam a dollar. The most sort of conservative estimate is we only get 93 cents back. So for every dollar we're sending to the federal government, Oregon is leaving at least 7 cents per dollar on the table. So with no new federal program, this is the fastest way that we can actually bring our dollars back to the state of Oregon and serve a lot of folks and free up money in our general fund. It is just just one of those triple bottom line type wins. And we have yet, in the 4 years I've been here now, fifth year that I'm here, have yet to make those investments from this body.
Where did it start?
I don't know who this question is to, but someone clarify. I'm trying to understand this discussion. So I'm going to give you a specific scenario. So if I understand what you're saying accurately, so if you guys can verify this, and this is why I asked about the discharge. So I joined the Navy. I got sent home after 17 days for a pre-existing medical condition. And so it was just they called it an erroneous entry is what they called my discharge. And so it wasn't, you know, anything negative reflective on me and everything. But from what you said, I would be counted in that 322,000. And what I think you're saying, even though I didn't make it through, but what you're saying is if I went down and filled out this information, then or even though I don't qualify for anything, nor should I, in my opinion, but that would bring, if I went down and filled out this information, that brings in more money to the state of Oregon to be used for others. Is that what you guys are saying?
Chair Geyer, Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark, members of the committee. let me clarify that a little bit. Based on the facts that you just gave me, you would not be considered in that $322,000
okay.
because it was a pre-existing condition that sent you home. However, had you entered the service and you were in basic training and then you incurred an injury or then at that point was sent home for a medical reason, a medical disability as a result of that injury,
okay.
then that you would be counted in that $322,000.
Got it. That helps to clarify that.
And Eric, can you say where Oregon stands? Are we in the bottom quartile of states that, in terms of our participation rates?
Chair Gittingeyer, members of the committee, you will see in a second what the numbers are. However, Oregon is a top 10 state in terms of the average compensation and pension rates that we are receiving compared to the national average. So despite the fact that we only have 3 in 10 veterans enrolled, we have a significant opportunity here to maximize benefits for our veterans, to improve their quality of life, to provide an opportunity for service members, veterans, and their family members to thrive in Oregon.
So are you saying that we're in the top five states, actually, in how well we're doing that way? There's still room to grow?
We're actually ninth, I think, when you combine the two.
Chair, I'll say, and maybe I'm stealing your thunder, but Oklahoma is a similar size state to Oregon in terms of veterans population. They actually serve about the same number of veterans we do, this sort of 3 out of 10. What they've done is they've done a better job of connecting people to their benefit and sort of taking them through the process. And I'll just explain. So Mark separated out, my husband separated out of the military 3 years ago this last month. He got an initial disability rating at X percent. Disability compensation is tax-free compensation, so he has retirement and he has some of his disability compensation. However, when we went through that process, they neglected to look at the fact that he's a spouse. They would acknowledge that you have a spouse. We sent our wedding certificate. They said, came back and said, did not rate him for a spouse. They rated him for children, which I'm not sure how he got those without the spouse, but they rated and acknowledged that he had kids, you know, dependent children. We submitted all of his service records, his health records, and Mark has, while not a formal diagnosis, essentially got sick from being the first Gulf War. He has, like, zipper scar down the front. They took out every organ that wasn't nailed down. You know, he had low platelet stuff where he almost bled like a hemophiliac. I mean, it was pretty bad. And so none of that has been counted in his disability rating, which means that when they finally get around to figuring it out, and now we're on the third submission of those records to the VA, when we are finally around to figuring that out, that means that disability rating will go up. So it's important to note that retirement income and disability income are two different things. The retirement income in Oregon, if you retired before October 1st of 1991, anything before 91, we don't tax that compensation. Anything you earned after 91, October 91, we tax that compensation. Disability compensation is not taxed. Mm-hmm. So that means those are real dollars being spent out in the community. So what that, and when you are like at 100% service-connected disability, mm-hmm. Those are people who really, you know, some of them really struggle mm-hmm. to go out and work. But it really jumps up that compensation level, which then gives folks the ability to not be in our community housing systems, not need our food stamp programs. And so, but that time gap of, like I said, Mark at 36 months, and I actually had one of our federal delegations said, hey, well, just call us, we'll take care of it. I'm like, we're not jumping the line. I'm going to sit here and play this out and see how this goes to the last minute, because then we're going to go fix it. So, so in that time gap, if you had a veteran in crisis, and they're not receiving some of this compensation or services or have access to the VA or prescriptions, they're winding up in our social safety net system, and it's just costing us a lot of money. And it is a slow, miserable process with the VA. I wish it wasn't that way. We can't fix that. But what we can do, you know, it's no secret, I've had a bill out to get lottery funds for veterans. If we had those funds, not only could we provide gap services, but as we properly align people, you know, then we get them the services. And I go back to the Oklahoma. So Oklahoma has helped them, like a veteran like Mark, that was the original point of the story, get all the way to the end of the process. Mm-hmm. That has generated, for serving about the same amount of veterans we do, an additional $400 million a year mm-hmm. in, like, disability compensation that is being spent in their communities. Mm-hmm. That's why this matters. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, Paul and Greg and I have all just been banging this drum so hard, is it's the right thing to do, but economically, it is a lift for our state and a savings to our general fund. And did I get all that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Kindergarten. Maybe I'll try to just simplify the question. Considering what Representative Evans has said and what Representative Parrish has said, why hasn't, and considering the big multiplier of $1 invested, and considering I'm new here, why haven't we done this?
What, Representative Paul Evans?
Because Paul's a crazy.
Representative Buehler. Chair Kenny Geyer, I think the best answer to that has two parts. The first is there was a package, there was an ask for funds going from the 2009 session, but we ran into the Great Recession. And the second piece is, in many people's minds, veterans policies are inherently federal government issues, not state government issues. And while that is technically true in the perfect world, we live in the world uniquely made by Oregon. And here's what I mean by that. We do not have any active duty military bases, nor the structures and systems associated with military bases and communities and veterans groups and veterans advocates, et cetera. The second thing is, for a long time, because our nation has fundamentally changed the way it fights wars. If you're really bored someday, I'll talk about my book on veterans reintegration.
I'd like to hear it.
But the bottom line is, we don't fight wars the way we used to, and 1%, 1.2% of the population is carrying the weight of this war. So people don't see it, they don't care. Often, symbol has replaced policies that would make a difference. And I'm hoping that this legislative session, with you being here new, with me being here new, with some others being here new, we can reorient the discussion. I'm hoping to try to get $10 to $15 million set aside for outreach programs that will hopefully help capture and harvest at least 10 times that amount and get people off other systems onto federally paid systems. But we will need everybody's support to make that happen. At the end of the day, we have a decision to make. Decision to make is, we can sit by and let the federal VA do what it's trying to do, lots of good intentions, but in many ways they're failing our veterans, or the state of Oregon can recognize that there are veterans to step up and fund at least a portion of the outreach programs that we need, because at the end of the day, this war, with 1% of the population fighting it, is now creating significant impact in terms of the corrections facilities across the state, especially among women veterans and families. It is causing a significant problem for our mental health care system and all the byproducts of problems long delayed. So, unfortunately, I don't have a better answer than we just didn't get around to it. I'm hoping we get around to it now.
You know what I can do to help.
Yes, sir, I will.
So this is really illuminating, because certainly the vets are a huge part of the population in the human service population, vulnerable populations in a number of different mental health, housing, DV, disability. It crosses a lot of different areas that we deal with in different departments. So it's great to have this cross-section and to have both of you serve on both those committees.
I will say, you need to go and have this conversation, and Paul and I should just go with you to every committee that needs to hear this as we try to figure out how we fund schools, fund roads, fund everything else. Bringing our federal dollar home through our veterans is a way to get there. And I think
sounds
every
like
legislator needs to hear that. And unfortunately, half of your choir in this committee is already in the veterans mm-hmm. committee. So,
yeah, but we have a lot of people here who are not. So, that, you know, yeah. It's great. Representative Beeler.
Yeah. So let me just ask this question to underline a point. Have you ever heard of patient-centered community care, which is a
veteran? Chair Gennegeier and Representative Beeler, yes, I have heard of that program.
So it's a $9 billion fully funded federal program that allows veterans who are a certain distance from a veterans health care facility to get medical care within their communities.
Vet card.
Very few veterans know about it. And it's a big burden for veterans in places like Central Oregon, who have to travel many times 4 hours across a treacherous pass for a 15-minute clinic visit and back, when they could have that same visit using the private medical system in their communities, but they just don't know about it.
Right. So do you want to answer that quickly? And then I was thinking
I don't want to answer that.
And then go. Just we want to let him finish his presentation, too. But
I just want to add a little bit of color to what Representative Beeler said. First of all, I'm not here asking, nor will I always ask, that veterans policy is more important than anything else. We have a lot on our agenda. Mm-hmm. I am asking for $10 to $15 million for veteran services out of a larger budget. Mm-hmm. But to add to Representative Beeler's point about the care problems, imagine, if you will, when we say what the representative just said, the four-hour trip to get to Portland, or depending on where they're at, perhaps to Boise. That van that they're in is driven by a volunteer who may be themselves a Korean War vet or World War II vet or something of that nature, trying to drive the van in not always great weather across treacherous roads.
Right.
So in many cases, even the approved system is an accident in waiting, And we have literally nickel and dimed ourselves along, and it's time for a more comprehensive approach for exactly the reasons that Representative Bueller and Parrish outlined.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we could definitely spend an entire session just talking about transportation issues and healthcare access.
And housing.
I would like to add that the 2013 legislature did invest another $1 million in the $3.5 million that we passed through to the county veteran service officers. And that over the period of time of that grant so far, we've projected that for that $1 million, more than $5 million will come back to Oregon veterans as a result of that $1 million investment. So another example of maximizing the benefits that the veterans have earned in their due to their military service, as well as the incredible return on investment that you get for the money.
Mm-hmm. I'll just add one more thing as a tax piece of this. When we talk about, you know, you heard Paul ask for $10 to $15 million, not like we get to do that in this committee. The lottery bill actually would do $26 million a year. And I want to go back to the Oklahoma piece, because that $400 million now spent out in your community is, then it was tax free when it, the veterans spent it, because they received it tax free, gets spent out into the community to a business that is going to pay taxes on it. If you just looked at our, we talked about what our income tax brackets rates are. If you just simply said, and it's maybe a little more complicated than that, but if you looked at $400 million a year, $800 million a biennium, and said, well, half of that's business expenses and half of that's taxable, at 9.9%, that's $40 million back. So it actually becomes net positive to the general fund. Mm-hmm. To say $400 million more a year taxed at, you know, almost 10% income tax rates back to the general fund, it becomes a free investment for the state to make to bring those dollars back. It doesn't actually wind up costing our general fund, even though we have to go through the Ways and Means process mm-hmm. and allocate it.
Right.
So now I will hush.
Thank you. Point well taken.
So of the three out of 10 veterans, obviously we want to be able to sign up more veterans for their benefits, whether it be disability compensation, pension, education, home loans, medical care, all the benefits that might be most appropriate for that particular veteran at that time in their life. And despite the fact that it's only 3 in 10, you can see that it still has generated a significant amount of work out of our Portland office in the last year, fiscal year 13-14, the number of claims and claims work that had been done is significant. And if you take a look, as Representative Evan mentioned earlier, take a look at the amount of money that has come in and how much that has grown just over the last 10 years from 2003 to 2013. Compensation has gone from $455 million to $1.5 billion in that length of time. And healthcare costs, health care benefits for those veterans that are enrolled in health care through the VA has gone from $392 up to almost $1 billion. Mm. So a significant amount of growth within the last 10 years during this period of conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan and throughout the world.
So are these separate from the other disability statistics we saw that it climbed up to 90,000 or veterans in a different classification, or are they lumped into the 90,000?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Bueller, they are figured differently than the general population. When I refer to disability compensation through the VA, that's as a result of a service-connected injury that they incurred and or aggravated while they were serving on active duty. So it is specifically tied to their service record. That you look for evidence in their service treatment records, you tie that with a nexus opinion today from a doctor that says, yes, this current condition is related to their service. The VA determines a level of disability, which I'll show you how that's broken down through the state, and then pays them for that level of disability.
Quick follow-up.
Yes.
So the increase to 90,000 doesn't include veterans.
On Mike's.
Right.
On Mike's
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Bueller, that's correct.
It doesn't include veterans
does
at
not
all.
Well, there may be veterans with whom have not accessed right. the system yet.
And they could be receiving both. You could be receiving Social Security disability as well as a VA disability compensation.
Could you try to identify for us out of that increase from 60 to 90, how many of them are vets?
Chair Kenny Geyer.
Either that are collecting benefits to the vets, or maybe who are I don't know if there's a way to
I will try. I will see what we can do.
And I think it's fair to say, sorry, Chair, the way the VA classifies a disability does not necessarily, for state services, qualify you as disabled. And I think that that's really important distinction to make, is they're saying, hey, we know that we injured you. We're going to compensate you for that injury. Hearing loss, you know, loss of a limb.
It may be a lower
PTSD
bar than the graph.
Than what we do in the state, which is why a lot of those, that you know, those numbers that you're seeing here for veteran disability, who that population is, may not qualify for any kind of disability services at all through the state.
Right.
And you'll see those disabilities, and it's true. These are, this doesn't mean they cannot work. The philosophy of the VA in paying disability compensation is to compensate for a reduced earning capacity.
Right. Right. Okay.
So even, you know, so within Oregon, just compensation for that disability amounts to $72 million per month in disability payments. And so that works out to an average of $14,695 for those veterans that are receiving a disability.
Yeah, I like that. Mm-hmm. That's good.
And where those payments go to are similar to the population figures that we looked at previously. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at the age groups and how disabled veterans are broken down, and there are approximately 60,000 service-connected disabled veterans in Oregon. Remember, service-connected being that tied to the military service and then rated by the VA. And so you can see the largest group is that 55 to 74-year-old group within the state of Oregon, but still a significant number of age 34 and under that are considered to be service-connected disabled by the federal VA. And if you look at that, how that breaks out into a percentage of disabilities, that's what that represents along the bottom. You can be service-connected and considered disabled by the VA even at 0%, which many times if you're service-connected for hearing loss, the majority of those cases is 0%. But you are eligible for all the or for many benefits under the VA even at 0% and state benefits. You receive no money, though. However, the farther you go up to 100%, you could be receiving a minimum of over $3,000 a month if you're married. If special compensation is added to that for significant impairments of disabilities that prevent someone from leaving the home and housebound or bedridden even. And then due to amputations. So you can see that the majority of them fall in that 0 to 10% range. If you're 10%, you receive $123 tax-free a month on up to that 100% figure. But you can see that that's over 7,000 right there just for 100% service-connected disabled veterans in the state of Oregon. And the last slide here, you can see the most prevalent service-connected disabilities. Not surprising, the military is a loud place, and so tinnitus, hearing loss are the two most commonly filed claims. PTSD is right behind them, and then a combination of those types of things that beat people up over a period of time, those musculoskeletal disorders. It doesn't matter how young and strong you are. If you hump up and down the mountains of Afghanistan with a lot of gear on your back, it's going to tear up your body, and that's what's reflected by these statistics. Mm-hmm. So that, subject to your questions, that concludes my formal part of the brief.
That was great. Any other questions? We had a really good, robust discussion.
I'll give you one more comment.
Yep.
If we can make these changes, and Rep. Evans and I, and out there somewhere in the city of Gresham is a rep, former Rep. Matthews, who wants to still be here helping us do this. If we do this, we become what I would call a welcome home state. So a state where we have policies and procedures in place where veterans choose to separate from the military and come to Oregon. And when they do that, when we have things, and we've passed a lot of policies, those who've been here, well, Penny and I are the only two sitting here today who've been here, we've passed things like the tuition and those things. When we have both policies and funding, we will have veterans who say, I want to make Oregon my home. And with that, then increase those numbers and bring their dollars here to Oregon. And I think, again, as a sort of long-term strategy, years in the future, having these policies and having the funding to go with them, it's also a skilled, educated workforce. A lot of our manufacturing companies really rely on these veterans. The helicopters, HTS and Columbia Helicopters up at the Aurora Airport, 40%, 50% workforce is veteran because they're coming with the skills. So to meet some of our 40-40-20 goals, adds new people into the mix. So there's a lot of other benefits in welcoming veterans home besides all of the hardship that sometimes goes with being a veteran.
Well, I have a question for you all. We are going to be opening a public hearing on all the different tax credits. You've talked a lot about some of the direct subsidies, the cash, the programs that either the feds or your coordination effort or the counties do to support vets. You've talked about how you support people with disabilities, either the physical and aging-related or the intellectual developmental disabilities. We have a series of tax credits, and we keep trying to figure out how do the tax credits fit in terms of helping individuals versus the kind of program outreach. So I wanted to give you an opportunity if there's anything that plays a key part of, you know, what you think is central strategy in serving the populations you serve. If I'm supposed to be following protocol, I can close the public hearing and have you at the informational meeting. I'm going to close the informational meeting and open the public hearing on all of them at once.
It's on your script.
Yep. House Bill 2119, House Bill 2120, House Bill 2121, House Bill 2122, House Bill 2123, House Bill 2124. So that is in order: severe disability, loss of limbs, elderly or disabled, child with a disability, long-term care insurance, costs in lieu of nursing home care. Probably the one that most directly affects your populations would be severe disability, in your case, in the vet services, and child with a disability in addition in yours.
Sure. Kenny Geyer.
Yeah.
In addition to those listed, there are two other tax credit bills that would have at least an effect on the population served by ODVA.
Mm-hmm.
One is the sunset coming up for a subsidy for docs in medical care in rural areas,
right,
which is coming up
in the healthcare committee.
Another one is probably coming up in a different committee having to do with tax credits for employment of veterans.
Uh-huh. It's probably in business and labor if it's not in veterans.
Since you're talking about tax credits,
right,
I wanted to make sure that those two were at least in the mix of what you're thinking.
And I will add one more because it affects families, is that we've got a bill that'll come up in veterans about survivor benefits.
Correct.
For pension survivor benefits, which is sort of a complicated thing, in that if you're when Mark retired, mm-hmm, he made the election to say that if I die, mm-hmm, we will reduce our compensation while he's alive, mm-hmm, so that as a spouse I have a survivor benefit. Mm-hmm. Oregon's one of only a handful of states in the nation that taxes that benefit. Mm-hmm. So if say the benefit was $40,000, right? That's what the soldier had earned. And then we're going to make an election to share that with a spouse upon the death of a veteran. They're going to reduce that amount of pay. It's sort of like winning the lottery, right? You can take it in cash, or you can take the annuity. So it's sort of like that. So when you reduce that amount, and then the spouse dies, then it's only a percentage of that pay. So now we're talking about someone whose spousal benefit might be $15,000, $16,000. So it's at that low income poverty level. Yeah. And then we tax that on top of it. And we are one of a handful of states that does that to low income spouses. And so we have a bill to look at addressing that as well.
Okay. So any general comments? I'm sure your government relations people get very nervous when I ask you for comments on bills. But if there's any general way, you know, do you ever look at tax credits and how that might complement? Maybe you can give some general statements. If not, that's fine. We'll see if anyone else wants to. No one has signed up for commentary on these bills, but I'm going to see if I can get anyone to. So here's your opportunity. Say anything general.
Chair Gengeyer and members of the committee, I can't address specifically these particular bills because we have not discussed them as as an agency team yet. However, I can talk about the popularity of the current property tax exemption. I worked for a number of years as a veteran service officer at the county level. And when a veteran attains a disability rating of 40% or more by the federal VA, then that then they meet the eligibility requirement for a property tax exemption here in Oregon.
Okay.
And whenever we had a veteran who met that threshold, you can bet that they ran right down to assessment and taxation and put in a formal application for it. So.
Great. Any general comments?
Chair Kenny Geyer, I apologize. I'm not prepared to offer any testimony on the tax credit bills before you today. But, of course, the underlying principle behind Oregon Revised Statute 410 is to support the independence, dignity, and choice of seniors and people with disabilities in Oregon. And my understanding of these tax credit bills from the ones I've read furthered that objective. But, of course, we do not have an official position or testimony on any of the tax credit bills before you today.
Okay, great. Yes.
And I just want to chime in on this, Chair Kenny Geyer, just to say no specific comments, but also related, I think you were looking at me when you were listing some of them. And outside of the anything related to the services or the for DHS, being a parent of a child with a disability is an amazing job. It's also an amazing challenge at times. And so anything that can be done to support those parents, I think in general, consistent with the goals of our program, we would support, whether it's no matter what the bill is. So I will leave it at that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Thank you for having us.
No one else has signed up, but would anyone like to? Please. John. On any six of those tax credits.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I apologize. I had to be out of the room when the sign-up sheet was out. John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. And also here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee. About these tax credits in general, the Human Services Coalition is supporting other tax credits, the working family, the child care tax credit, and the IDA tax credit, independent development accounts. Those tax credits alone are about $36 million of the 64 that are about to sunset. And as I think this committee really realizes, the co-chairs allocated $14 million for expiring tax credits. So the thing that I just really want to emphasize is that this committee has done a terrific job with looking at the tax credits that come before you. Our sense about the elder and disability tax credits is some of them could be targeted better, may be able to be combined with other tax credits. Whenever the committees that are looking at it from a policy perspective, of course, need to look at efficiency, effectiveness, how well things are targeted. Sometimes there is a better opportunity to achieve goals through spending through the budget rather than through tax credits. So I would just say that as you're deliberating around these, just to mention again that the Human Services Coalition is neutral on these particular ones. I don't know if the long-term care insurance one is also one that's up today.
It is.
That one, I just would specifically mention a little bit about that, you may, in fact, if you want to dive deeper, hear a little bit from the insurance commissioner about long-term care insurance. It's a complicated issue. It's a product that a lot of people don't purchase for a number of reasons that are really very good, relating to coverage, but also cost and the price volatility. And meanwhile, there are a number of insurers that are leaving the marketplace because of those reasons as well. So once again, and as Mike McCormick pointed to 410, as he was finishing out his testimony, we have a number of things that we've done that have really been innovative with serving people in the community. The intent of long-term care insurance is, of course, is to help people be able to pay for long-term care when they need it. The affordability of it, though, means that there tends to be a range of people that are higher income, but if Mr. Knight will forgive me using him as an example, Phil Knight does not need long-term care insurance because he can simply pay for anything that he needs out of pocket. So it covers a band of people, but it's not very effective from our point of view in looking at this over the last number of years. But I thank you for the opportunity to testify and be happy to try to respond to any questions.
Any questions?
Yep. Thank you. On the long-term care specifically, if you had to put an income number on that that makes sense, where somebody is going to use it and is really working towards moving the dial on trying to save for retirement. I mean, I have some of these communities in my district where people are totally self-sufficient of the government. They're not, and they've saved and they've put some of these dollars away, maybe even use this credit, I don't know. But we do have folks who are trying to be thoughtful planners so that they aren't wrapped into a Medicare situation down the road. Like, what income level do you think where that still makes sense, and what income level would you like to see that be phased out at? I mean, Phil Knight's sort of a one thing. You know, where is the cap in your mind where we should cap that? And, I mean, I'd like to have a sort of a robust discussion amongst this group at some point about how we maybe make some modifications, because I still think that people sort of in that 70 to 120 income range who are trying to do that, I'm thoughtfully planning and putting away and aside, save a lot of money. This potentially saves a lot of money down the road if they actually are adequately planning. So kind of where in your head?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, this is an excellent question. The way that I think about this is that we don't have the right product available, so the income distribution, I'm relying on memory, falls mostly in the fourth quintile. You know how the Department of Revenue divides things up. So it is really people beyond the median income that generally take advantage of that particular opportunity. To me, if we were to redesign this, it's a bigger discussion. I would love to see us have better products available that would entice younger people to buy in. So it could be some combination life, disability, and long-term care insurance, maybe even with a whole life kind of savings aspect to it. But I'm not an insurance expert by any stretch of the imagination. But I just think that the intent maybe was a good one. And, you know, for a number of years back in running Clackamas County Social Services, and we were looking at this as an opportunity for doing, as you say, for people to save prudently, and they wouldn't then wind up spending down to the Medicaid level. But I just don't think it's really the right fit right now. So we have basically said, as the Human Services Coalition, letting this one go would not upset the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. But I think for a future planning discussion, bringing the insurance commissioner in, and this may not be for this session, but taking a look at redesigning it. For example, the product that I mentioned, even if, say, for example, public employees paid the full freight for that, but it was available to them and there was a discount because of group purchase, it could really be an opportunity to educate people, and it would also potentially gravitate to employers outside of the public sector that might look at this as an opportunity to do some group pooling and getting better costs for people. But it's a great question, and I don't have a full answer to that, but there are experts in insurance that I would love to see us get to a better place in designing a program that works.
Okay. That one, by the way, cost last two years, $19 million, and it was mostly people over $100,000. As you say, that particular instrument is not as usable for people who are struggling to put away money at lower levels. So I do think that looking at something that might be a better product that wasn't around when we first passed this is worth looking at. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else want to testify? I just want to make sure that people on the committee, as well as the public, knows that on OLIS we have two different reports that are under Chris Alanuck's name. One is the whole long report, I think it's about 100 pages long, of 2016 expiring tax credits and the areas that cover the disabilities, aging and disabilities, are pages 55 to 60. A few things about those particular, the two that are more expensive, the severe disabilities is about $10 million per biennium. There is no means test on that right now. And the child with disabilities is also about $10 million. There's no means testing on that one as well. The elderly and disabled and the loss of limbs are not used very much. The elderly one only is about $75,000 a year that's given out in credits, the average credit being $55. And the loss of limbs is $25,000 $1,000. I forget. I think that's the loss of two limbs, which, of course, is also covered under the severe disabilities. So we have a lot of little credits here that, you know, it'd be hard to argue they make a huge difference in people's lives, and an opportunity to say, if you have a big chunk of money, $10 million for this, $10 million for that, $20 million for this, you know, are there better ways to use that? Maybe through Project Independence, as you said, to extend that to the people with disabilities, or veteran services that have a return on investment through, you know, federal dollars. There's all kinds of ways. So, you know, I think unless there's really good reason, and that's why I'm going to put this out to the public, like, you know, let us know, be on alert that we're going to take a really hard look. And if it doesn't look like there's a very strong, compelling reason to use our dollars here as opposed to elsewhere, then we're not going to be rubber stamping them and just passing them on. So I want to just come make sure that people who are connected to the to those communities, you know, have a chance to take a good look and get back to us on it. Yeah.
So I appreciate the conversation, and I think that it's totally appropriate to come back and are the things that we're doing in government, not just tax expenditures and deductions and things, but everything we're doing in government, is it appropriate, and is there still a need, or are we still operating something for just an internal constituency group? My one point of caution as we have this discussion is that there is a constituency group tied to every one of these things, and I don't remember if you were here or not when we...
The Blind Commission?
No. I wasn't here for that one either. I think it was 2011 when the legislature passed out a bill that would make an adjustment in the senior property tax deferral.
Oh, yeah.
And we put it out, and then right at tax time, they all got letters.
Right.
And the entire state was spinning up our emails because they're... Unfortunately, this project, this process, while we feel it's open and transparent, people can come and fill our chairs that are empty here on a Friday afternoon, the reality is that the taxpayer at home is not watching us on legislator TV.
Right.
Really?
So if you're Representative Bueller, if you're hoping to get scouted for some TV show from our Ledge TV circuit, I'm sorry. So we're going to make changes, and then they're going to go to file their taxes on April 15th of 2016, and our emails are going to get spun up that something that they came to rely on is gone. And the problem I have how we make changes in these decisions is that notification to somebody who maybe previously used one of these tax credits, particularly even one as small as $75,000, how can we be thoughtful about either working with the Department of Revenue to put some sort of notification out that this is going away? Please do not plan on it because we're making changes. And I think there has to be a better way because people are going to freak out when some even for $55, we may not think that's a lot of money, but if you are poor, $55 buys a cartload of groceries. So I think we have to be really cautious about how we move forward and try to consolidate. The goal is right, how we communicate it to the public. I do not see anybody from the press sitting here saying that we are having this conversation. Please contact your legislator and tell them what matters to you. So I've been down that road before, and it was painful. And then we had to come back, and we had to fix it. And I had constituents in my community who came unhinged. Yes, there are low-income people who live in West Lynn. So... anyway, I just want us to be thoughtful and cautious moving forward.
No, point well taken, but I came into the legislature right after that decision had been made, so I wasn't a part of the decision, but I certainly heard about it when I was there when the taxes hit and when people got back to us. We had a Halloween event at the senior center in Hollywood, which was right after people found out, and that was very dramatic because people actually could not hold on to their homes.
That's right.
I mean, the order of magnitude is dramatically different than the 55, but still, point well taken. That, you know, people come to rely on things, and we need to have done our due diligence and really having thought through why we're doing something in order to be able to justify those decisions, and then. Point well taken on the communication. It's always a challenge. Please help us out there to the extent you can.
And Chair, I'm wondering if, while we may not be able to be the ones to send letters to tax citizens, I'm curious if we should get someone from Department of Revenue who can come here and talk to us about how can we better think about communicating with folks on and task them with that. that somebody who, we're going to totally eliminate one of these things, that,
take a note of that.
They know who took these credits. They can, like, I asked them the other day for some information on how many people are military retirees, and they get a certain letter, you know, 1099R or whatever, and they were able to pull up a lot of data about who those people are. So they know who those people are. So while we're not going to get that information as legislators, it's not a matter of public record, they have that information. I do not know what it would cost to send out a letter to say, in 2015 you took this tax credit, and in 2016 it's no longer going to be available to you. But to the extent that, as we're sunsetting things and permanently making them go away, I would like to explore every avenue to make sure we're communicating with people who've taken those credits in the past and are still Oregon residents.
So we will ask revenue what that might cost, both to dig up the information and then to send it out, because it may exceed the $55. But again, good point. worth asking about. I think with that, because it's been a long week,
district,
and everyone
I'll provide
wants
the stamps.
Okay,
how's that?
That's good. Yeah. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2119, 2120, 2121, 2122, 2123, and 2124. At our next meeting on Monday, we'll have a broad discussion on. Oh.
Should we open that up right now?
Okay. And we're going to have a second panel now. Bob Junduff, Executive Director of Disability Rights. Nicole Palmateer, Hazel Baker, Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. Information meeting.
Good.
Chair Kinnegayer, members of the committee, Bob and I thought that the meeting was almost over,
yes,
but
sorry.
Here we are. But thank you. My name is Nicole Palmateer, now Hazel Baker. I'm still getting used to that. Here today on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, I will be as brief as possible. Thank you for having this conversation about people with disabilities and services and supports. We're here to provide an on-the-ground perspective, if we can. The Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities provide a number of services and long-term care services and supports around the state, including the Oregon Project Independence Program that's been previously referenced, Aging Disability Resource Connection, the ADRCs, and in certain areas of the state, we are the administrators of the Medicaid system for people with disabilities and for older adults. In order to be able to speak a little bit about the on-ground perspective, I spoke with case managers, eligibility specialists, as well as individuals with disabilities who are currently receiving services. So I'm really here just to relay what they told me, and it was great. I always learn a lot when I speak to these people, and it really it helps me stay motivated about what we do. One of the questions we talked about was, how do these people access services, individuals with disabilities? A lot of times they access them based on recognizing an individual need, most often related to trying to stay in their own home or in whatever their current setting is. And the need for some help with what we call activities of daily living is often what drives that first phone call in an urban area, walking into an office, to an area agency office, into an APD, an aging and physical disabilities office. That tends to be it, as well as a crisis situation, a medical need. Also, homelessness is something that we see quite a bit for individuals with disabilities as a driving force between in order to have them come look for services, and hospital referrals. The other piece of it that's new that the department referenced in their testimony is the funding that was allowed by the 1315 biennial legislature to invest in Oregon Project Independence for people with disabilities. That was a policy change that happened around 2005, but we had never been able to implement it. Before that, the program was limited only to older adults. With the investment, we've been able to pilot this in 5 areas around the state. We do find out that there is, in fact, a need. Oregon Project Independence provides services to people who are most at risk for a premature, unnecessary move into a higher acuity care setting, out of their home perhaps, or into a community-based care facility that's perhaps not necessary, or onto an entitlement program. So this is a way to put a little bit of money to help somebody be able to retain their independence with the funding for the implementation of the pilot. We've been able to do further outreach and find that the need is here, and not just in the metro areas. We have a pilot in Eastern Oregon, on the coast, Southern Oregon. We've tried to be geographically dispersed around the state, and we see that the need is there. The individuals with disabilities that I spoke to noted that the ADRC, the Aging and Disability Resource Connection, which is a federal initiative through the Administration for Community Living that's moving across the country, Oregon is implementing it as well, has also been a very promising way, they said, to bring more information about services to people with disabilities. And they felt that people with disabilities are becoming more accustomed to being able to access services through this. The concept is that you have a kind of a no-wrong door, a place where you can go to find the information you need on a more in-depth level to help guide you to where you need to go, and they felt that that had been very promising. Kinds of services that are most often needed, our case managers said, again, maintaining independent living, medical needs, mental health services are escalating in the requests they're receiving as far as how to access services for those. Cash assistance for during the Social Security process, and I know that goes to the general assistance conversation that we're having, but by and large, the number one thing that I heard from my case managers, eligibility specialists, and individuals with disabilities is housing. Housing, not just affordable housing, but accessible housing. And they noted that for an individual with a disability, perhaps a housing option might become available, but that housing is most often not accessible for an individual with a disability. So even if you have affordability, you still have to have accessibility, and that isn't something that the individuals that I talked to who are currently receiving services felt like was necessarily a part of that broader housing conversation. I, for one, had not really thought about that, so I appreciated that perspective. Both case managers and individuals both agree that there's always more demand than supply, but one of the options through the K plan has allowed them to have some different ways to receive services that have been really beneficial. So that's been a positive move. I would say that the individuals with disabilities I spoke with brought up that within their community, they feel that there's a lot of concern when you expand services, will they be the first ones to be cut? People who are perhaps more on the high utilization side of the fence and become more costly, is that going to be where you look for when at some point there might have to be cuts to be made, and that causes them to be very concerned. Our case managers noted that I asked them kind of the what is needed but we can't supply, and they said the services for individuals, you've all heard about the activities of daily living and the levels, service priority levels 1 through 18. In Oregon, we had to cut levels 14 through 18 back in the early 2000s, around 2001, 2003, those levels were cut from services under Medicaid, and we've never been able to restore those. Our case managers say that help in those levels is one of the most significant needs that they hear about. You need help with some ways to help structure your living, such as bathing or dressing, the things that help you kind of stay when you're right on the border, how can you still stay in your own home? But currently under Medicaid, those services aren't provided. Oregon Project Independence can serve up to level 18. So again, there's a lot of promise there to be able to address that gap, but it is something that they noted is a need that they feel it's very difficult for them to not be able to address that, something that is could be fairly minimal care, but could really help someone maintain their independence. When I asked both of the groups about challenges, the case managers and individuals with disabilities said community inclusion is one of the greatest challenges that they both face. So while we can provide services, for example, through the Medicaid system, it's pretty prescribed, it's pretty formulated what you're allowed to do, but it doesn't address how to be included in your community, how to have a robust, vibrant experience in your community. It will address your medical needs, your transportation needs to an appointment, you know, related to what your needs are. But what it doesn't necessarily address is if you want to go on an outing with your friends, if you want to go to the park, if you want to, you know, participate in a book club, those things aren't necessarily addressed in a way that truly honors community inclusion for people with disabilities. And they thought that, you know, an emphasis on that would really overall help kind of what we consider the social determinants of health and the way that, you know, how you're able to live in your community. Individuals with disabilities noted that employment support would be really important to them, and they know that that's a continual challenge here legislatively to be able to find the funding for that. And they noted that not just employment support to the individual with a disability, but continuing education to employers about the role that, you know, or the opportunity that there might be to look at hiring somebody who has in our case, we work with people with physical disabilities, but I'm sure Mr. Junedeff would agree, you know, how could you, you know, what kind of benefit these people could provide to your place of business, to your organization, by looking at that, and what that means also, again, in terms of accessibility. A small investment might really realize some great benefits for an individual you're able to hire and give a job. And again, housing. We heard housing over and over and over. Finally, I did ask the question about tax credits, only specific to the tax credit for people with disabilities. So I want to be sure you know that that's the only one I talked to the case managers and to the individuals I spoke to about with disabilities. In general, our case managers said that they are not aware of individuals with disabilities asking for those tax credits. The people who are coming to us for services are probably not the people who are most highly utilizing those kinds of credits. And the individuals that I spoke to said that, in general, it's not on their radar at all. So it does seem that perhaps there is another discussion to have there if one wants to look at who is utilizing that and if the focus might be a little bit different. But that was the feedback that was given to me by the people I had a chance to speak to. So thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions and send it on to Bob.
I have a question about Project Independence, but I'll wait until after Bob goes, because you might address it too.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon. Disability Rights Oregon came into being in 1977. It was designated by Governor Straub as the protection and advocacy system for the state of Oregon. And what that means is that there was a federal act passed back in 76 that provided for legal-based advocacy services then for people with developmental disabilities. And since that time, the programs were expanded to encompass all disabilities. And so from our office in Portland and with outreach workers, we provide those legal-based advocacy services to all Oregonians with disabilities. I'm not going to repeat all of the issues that you've heard, because each one of them are ones that come to us through individuals who call with complaints and through our monitoring activities and institutions where people bring problems to us as well. We go through an annual priority setting process in which the public gives input into the types of things we should work on every year. And they normally break down into the very issues that you've already heard about. I think it's interesting to note, when you're thinking about the how to address tax issues, is that our program, eligibility for our program, was not based upon income. It was based upon the existence of a disability. Many of the state programs that you've heard about have income limitations placed upon them. Our program does not, although we heavily prioritize people who are low income, who have been determined to be eligible for federal disability and state disability programs. But I think that's an important factor, because, again, one overall message that emerges when you hear what people with disabilities have to say about their lives is that people want to be more integrated into society. They want to be less dependent upon public services. They want to have jobs. They want to have homes. They want to have access to a good education, all the things that anyone else wants in a life. And the mere fact that one has acquired or been born with a physical or cognitive disability or a mental health problem or a brain injury should not interfere with those, certainly do not interfere with those desires. And to the extent that modifications can be made in our buildings and in our services and supports can be provided to allow people to succeed in life, that we all benefit, because that person now has a greater chance to achieve their individual goals. Their families become less burdened by having to provide services to a person who now can do things for themselves. And those people can become productive taxpayers. And if you look at the federal policies that come to us through our federal funding sources, and nationally through advocacy groups and locally, that's really the entire focus and target, is to try to move people toward more independence, particularly more financial independence. Mm-hmm. So just as an example of that, as the years have progressed, about a quarter of our federal funding is specifically targeted to supporting people in employment activities. We have a program that specifically to help people in vocational rehabilitation services when they're experiencing problems in that public system. We have a program that's specifically designed to help people who are experiencing discrimination or barriers in terms of employment. And we have a program that is funded by the Social Security Administration, which is specifically to give people information and tools they need to go back to work and to be able to transition from public supports to independence without unnecessarily risking their health care, their food supports, and their employment supports. So all these policies are geared in that direction, which is what brings me to tax credits. I am not sitting before you as an expert on tax credits. I think the last time I looked at tax with any care was in law school. I did pass that course. I would like to put that on the record. But I think I am familiar when I look at the bills before you as to what the thinking was behind them. And one of the things I did distribute to the committee was the latest economic employment statistics that were just released, and there was a lot of fanfare about the fact that the unemployment rate is coming down. You may notice, however, that while the unemployment in the document that I provided you, it provides specific information about people with disabilities in the employment market. And this means people with disabilities are ready, willing, and able to work, but are experiencing unemployment. And what it shows, and this has been stubbornly consistent over the years, is that the rate of unemployment for people with disabilities is twice as high as it is for people who do not experience a disability. And when you look at the disparity between people who overall as adults who work as opposed who when compared to those who don't work, we get up to a comparison of 68.2% of people who are working who do not have a disability, 19.8% of people with a disability who are not working. So as you can see, this is a social problem, and it not only is burdensome for those individuals, but also for their families and for society as a whole. So the question I would pose to the chair and for members of the committee when you tackle these tax issues is to look at what is the policy and incentive that we have behind them. One of the difficulties that people with disabilities have faced have been basically wanting to go back to work, wanting to become less dependent on public services, and yet finding a cliff before them in which all of a sudden they do not have any support whatsoever, and they do not have any recognition of the fact that having a disability can be quite expensive. Just in terms of making modifications to the home, having access to durable medical equipment, usually heightened medical services that are necessary, the transportation costs, and other costs that are just associated with the disability. I took a moment before I came down, went to my favorite research source, the internet, in order to look for some information about if there had been studies about the costs to families of having a child with a significant disability. And I found a study from 2 years ago that pegged the cost at about $30,000 per year for a family that has a child with a significant disability. The greatest part of that cost is the fact that a parent needs to stop working or scale back their work in order to deal with the child's heightened needs. But there are other costs associated as well. So I think it's important to keep those in mind. Keep in mind the fact that we don't want to create impediments for people to work and to be productive. And we also want to help families who, frankly, even though the Developmental Disabilities Services provide very important services for folks with developmental disabilities, significant disabilities, We do rely upon those families to take care of of their kids. And when we closed institutions, we at Oregon and many states that are very progressive in their attitudes said, we are not going to ask families to just give up their children and send them to a large institution. We're going to provide them with some support so that they can keep their loved one at home. But frankly, the amount that we provide is limited. And families, we are depending upon those families to step up and care for the kids in a way that's important for them, obviously, but also helps us as a state. So I think that we need to recognize that. So I, with that, I just quickly comment that, again, particularly House Bill 2122 has to do with children with disabilities. And so that's one that I think Chair Kenny Geyer mentioned was one that is used a lot, and I can imagine it is. The long-term care insurance premiums, one other piece of information I just wanted to provide about that is that when the Affordable Care Act was passed, it had a provision that tried to address some of the complexities of long-term care insurance and the recognition that it's very costly and most people don't use it because they're not thinking about what's going to happen when they get to my age. And so there was a provision in that act that provided some incentives for savings as well as some federal match. That ultimately was removed from the act because it was considered to be not fiscally feasible as part of that act. But it is a policy that has been looked at quite a bit on the federal level as well as locally. And I guess my ultimate message is I think before, as an advocate for people in our public systems, I'd like some of that money too for them. But before we precipitously move on it, I think we need to look at the overall policies behind them, make sure that they're efficient, they're not overlapping or redundant, and they work to further our goals of community integration for people with disabilities and not to exacerbate barriers that people have to doing that.
So I'm hoping that you can take a really hard look at those and see whether those are efficient vehicles to help independence or whether, you know, it's better spent doing programs that get at inclusion and some of the other things. Is the extra pocket money, and we'll have to drill down to see what is the average amount. Some the reports say on some of them and not others, and what's the range? And if you were going to have a cutoff, if you were going to do means test, what would make sense? If we continue these, you know, if we continue them, then we try to not make it a general economic instrument, you know, that we try to target it perhaps more than it is now. So any feedback you can give on those would be really helpful. Questions? I had a question about Project Independence. Can you just give overall for the scale, what are we spending right now for the elderly to stay in their homes? What are we, and how many people does that cover? What is this pilot with for people with disabilities? How many people is that? And are we talking about doubling it if we included all the people that we could target with people with disabilities, or having it grow by 20%, just scale-wise?
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, it's a good question, and I would actually defer to the department. They're going to have the exact numbers, but I would say the pilot project for people with disabilities was funded at $3 million for its current biennium, and I believe, and they can correct me if I'm wrong, that currently we have around or close to 300 people. We got a late start on it because of when the funds came in, so it's been a process of ramping up and getting it going around the state in the areas that we're utilizing it in right now, and part of the pilot project was actually to look at, since this is new for Project Independence, what is the need that we see? How does it roll out? does it have to look a little bit differently than what the program has looked like for older adults? What do we think it would take to take it statewide? How much? What would that dollar amount be? How many people do we think we might be able to serve if we truly were able to roll it out right alongside the current program that we have with older adults? For this particular pilot, Northwest Senior and Disability Services, which is the area agency that serves Marion Polk, Clatsop, Yamhill, and Tillamook counties, is the lead agency, so is implementing the pilot as the lead and fiscal administrator for it, and they've been doing a great job of gathering all kinds of data.
It's okay. He's unmuted himself.
Joe, can you mute yourself unless you have a question?
Sounds like he has it on speaker.
Yeah.
And therefore, to, she says
Joe, are you there? We can try to mute. That's just muting us. We don't want to mute us.
Yeah, I'm trying to.
Okay. I can also turn that down, maybe.
Yeah, I turned it down.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
It's okay. For seniors, the program was invested in at, I believe, $21 million total over the course of the 13-15 biennium, which is a market increase from what we've had in the past. And the investment has been in increments throughout the biennium due to varying funds available from the special purpose appropriation for seniors due to the original revisions to the senior medical expense deduction that happened during the special session. So it's been kind of progressive. I would say that when we've been able to bring people in, we've been able to bring them in off wait lists, but we continue to build wait lists around the state. You know, the need is definitely there for individuals, for older adults who are really trying so hard to maintain their independence. But at about $300 a month, roughly, or so, turns out we can do a lot to help them stay in there. I don't have the number off the top of my head in the senior program. I think it's 3,000.
It's about
3,000 seniors that we're serving right now through Project Independence, I think, but I will get you the most current number and make sure that the committee members have that.
So the $300 a month is not cash to them?
No, it's general services. Fund dollars and services. Usually services in your home that might help, grocery shopping, housekeeping, right. Helping you with, you know, whatever those things might be to allow you to stay in your home and avoid unnecessary premature movement into either an entitlement program, a facility-based setting, or something like that. And I can provide just a quick one-pager on kind of what those services look like and what we're currently doing with the pilot, and we'll distribute that out to the committee.
Okay. Questions? Thank you so much. Thank you for waiting with us to the very end. Okay. So close the informational meeting. And getting ready for the weekend. We'll on Monday we'll have a broader discussion on tax credits, and we'll hear 2219, 2091, and re-refer 2585 and House Bill 3129 to the Committee on Energy and Environment. Any other announcements? Okay.
We're adjourned. Nice done.
Okay.
All right.